Stop it. Sisters, brothers and sisters, brothers and sisters, come on now.
It's 1969 and the Rolling Stones are on world tour. Their last stop? A free concert in California at the Altamont Speedway. Just months after Woodstock, the West Coast wants its major 60s moment. But it doesn't go as planned.
That means everybody just cool out.
This is Stefan Ponick, KSAN Radio, San Francisco. Well, the Rolling Stones' tour of the United States is over. They wound it up with a free concert at the Altamont Speedway for more than 300,000 people. There were four births, four deaths, and an awful lot of scuffles reported. We received word...
I was in Altamont. I had took it. It was laced with probably downers and uppers. So I was really crazed. I got harried out by people.
It was insane, and it... There were violence. The Hells Angels were doing security for the Rolling Stones, and they actually stabbed and murdered somebody on the stage. And it was just, you know, sort of awful and crazy.
Ted Kapchuk and Michelle Kramer are a couple in their 20s. The morning after the intense experience at Altamont, they receive a surprise visit.
And we were at that concert, and then we got home like at 3 o'clock in the morning. We were asleep, and it... 7 o'clock in the morning, Ted Gulp jumped on top of us.
Wow. Ted Gould is their best friend.
And it was really fun. It was like he was in a really good mood. He was like playful. It's like, how the fuck did he find us? The first thing he said is, Ted, I can't tell you where I live. I can't tell you what I do.
But what they do know about Ted is that he's a member of the Weathermen, a group of radical leftists surveyed by the FBI.
Then he says to me, he says, Ted, you're not going to hear from me, and you'll never see me. And I knew that meant he was going underground. And he said very clearly, I'm going to do things that you are not capable of doing, and I don't want you to do those things. And, you know, we hugged real intensely. We said, you know, we love each other. And he disappeared.
This is Shoe Leather, an investigative podcast that digs up stories from New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today. This season, we're going to 1970, Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities find out that the townhouse was ground zero for the operations of five members of the Weather Underground, a radical group of young revolutionaries who used violence to bring the war home.
Ted Gould is one of the five people in the townhouse when the bomb explodes. He's a student at Columbia University and a fierce opponent of the Vietnam War.
Is that we've got to stand firm, we've got to stand together, we've got to stand united, say screw you to the administration, you don't have that right to discipline us.
But before all that, he's a witty New York City kid who loves the Yankees, Bob Dylan, and Karl Marx. His friends say he is reliable, fearless, and a ladies' man.
But how does a nonviolent kid like that end up in a townhouse in Greenwich Village?
What leads a 22-year-old to be fearless of dying?
And what does it mean when your best friend becomes radicalized? I'm Jenny Gottiner.
And I'm Gustav Mückenstuhl. This is Shoe Leather Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong. You're listening to Episode 3, The Comrade.
This is a story about politics, radicalism, and bombs. But before all that, let's go back to the summer of 1960. The Civil Rights Act was just signed. In a few months, JFK will be elected president of the United States. And Ted Gould's spending the summer in upstate New York. He's at summer camp.
Do you mind if I record our conversation?
Not at all.
Okay.
So it was called Camp Woodland for Children. It was located in Phoenicia, New York, in the Catskills.
That's Michael Cohen. He went to Camp Woodland in the early 60s, at the same time as Ted Gould.
Ted Gould wasn't in my tent, so I think he might have been a year younger.
Besides the typical activities...
We did hiking, we climbed mountains.
There were some unique traditions.
We had a competitive Olympics between the different bunk groups, and my unit was named for Cuba. This camp was a leftist camp. We were sort of idolizing, in a way, the radical governments around the world.
But in 1962, Camp Woodland shuts down. Some say it's under scrutiny for having links to the Communist Party. They reopen in a new location and rebrand as Camp Webatuck. Kids who go there are red diaper babies, which means they're children of communists. Julie Kenter is one of them. She meets Stedgold when they're 15.
There were probably children, a lot more children of activists whose parents sent them away to have a peaceful summer, because at that time there were a lot of people being harassed by the FBI.
By then, the FBI is routinely keeping tabs on anyone they suspect of being communist.
It was a nice place for children to be, where they were safe.
Ted comes from a communist family. He lives on the Upper West Side, on 93rd and Amsterdam, with his younger brother and his parents, Ayman and Ruth Gold. Ruth is a professor at Columbia University's Teachers College, and Ayman is a doctor. He volunteers in Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement. He and Ted are close. It's no surprise when his parents send him to a left-wing camp. Michael Pastor also went to camp with Ted.
He was compact, strong-looking, he wore glasses.
And he remembers how music played a big role at the camp.
Like that one time, Bob Dylan's mentor, Pete Seeger, came to visit.
You know the song Guantanamera? Pete Seeger learned that song at camp from one of the counselors who came from Cuba. And he knew the song. And me and another guy was sitting there as this guy literally was teaching it to Pete Seeger, and he was writing it down and transcribing it. And then, then the next time we heard it was at Carnegie Hall or something like that. Guantanamera,
Guaira Guantanamera. And like at any camp, there's summer romance. Judy has a big crush on Ted.
And he had another girlfriend at the time. And I guess she broke up with him. And we started going together. But then I guess just before the March on Washington, they decided to get back together. So I only remember being miserable on the bus down to Washington because I wasn't with him.
The march Judy is talking about is the famous 1963 March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech. The kids from camp, including Ted, Judy, and the two Michaels, all meet up in the city before heading down to D.C.
I remember with two of my friends working our way to the front of the crowd just in time to hear Bob Dylan sing Blowin' in the Wind, and then to hear Martin Luther King speak. And I don't think we fully understood the historical significance of that speech.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
We knew it was a good speech. But I don't think we knew that all these years later, people would be talking about the I Have a Dream speech. I mean, we were kids. We just wanted to get near the front so we could see better, you know.
And so ends another summer at camp for Ted Gold and his 13-year-old friends. Over the next couple of years, Camp Webatuck will be investigated for its links to the Communist Party and even attacked by right-wing militias. At the same time, Ted Gold is becoming even more politically active.
It's 1964, Ted Gold's senior year at Stuyvesant High School, one of New York's elite public schools. After hearing Martin Luther King speak, he's fired up to participate in the civil rights movement. Robert Siegel is one of his classmates. He will later become a legendary host for NPR.
Well, I remember that he was a very political high school student, very engaged in in politics, and he was the head of a group which was called the Stuyvesant High School Friends of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
The organization collects food in the north to send down south to support communities that have been cut off from welfare. In 1964, SNCC organizes the Freedom Summer, a movement to register as many black voters as possible. Northern white teenagers like Ted are genuinely welcome in the organization, until SNCC asks its white volunteers to leave the space for black people in 1966.
Now, we've maintained that we cannot have white people working in the black community, and we've made it on a psychological ground. The fact is that all black people often question whether or not they are equal to whites, because every time they start to do something, white people are around showing them how to do it.
Ted was at the famous meeting of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. The white kids were told to leave SNCC to black activists. Mm-hmm. And that was very disorienting to a lot of kids who were white radicals, liberals, whatever it was that they would have been.
He was the last person that SNCC threw out of SNCC, white person.
Ted Kapchuk and Ted Gold meet in high school. They soon become best friends. Everyone calls them the two Teddies.
They threw out all the whites. Ted wouldn't leave until they forced him out. He said, I'm fighting with you guys. They told me to leave. I left.
Ted Gold may be more dedicated than the others, but he still has to leave the group.
There was a moment that leaves people like Ted politically unhoused. Mm-hmm. And Ted found a home in the movement protesting against the war in Vietnam.
One of the only photos of Ted Gold is from the 1968 protests at Columbia University. He's wearing a flannel and square glasses and seems to be mid-speech as he smiles at a group of fellow SDS members. SDS, Students for Democratic Society. It's the largest student activist group in the U.S. at the time. In the photo, Ted's shoulder to shoulder with a taller guy, practically linking arms. And you can tell they're close in the way that friends quickly become at college.
The guy in the photo is Ted Kapchuk, his high school and now college pal. The two Teddies are running Columbia's SDS. In some ways, they're opposites.
He liked music, he liked dancing, he liked a good time. I would just as soon read a book. And that was really the difference. He understood that I was much more in my head than he was. He was more in the earth. He was much more, he got things done. He didn't hesitate for a minute.
Ted Gold doesn't do anything halfway. When he commits, he goes all in.
His girlfriend at the time, Judy, I forgot her name, she liked this an advertisement on the subway of a horse. And he went in the middle of the night and stole it from the subway, and he brought it to his house, and he brought it to her. And I was like, wow, what a nice thing to do for your girlfriend, right?
And it's the same way when it comes to politics.
I would be all over the fucking place, and he would just say, what are we doing? And he would just fucking do it. Whatever was hardest to do, he did, not me. That was the way he was. Mm. He was not afraid of doing hard things.
In 1968, an anti-war protest breaks out on campus. It lasts a week. Five buildings are occupied, and the acting dean of the university is held hostage for 24 hours in Hamilton Hall.
Dean of Columbia College, Henry S. Coleman, confronts demonstrators in the lobby of Hamilton Hall.
Am I to understand, then, that I am not allowed to leave this building?
Well, let me ask. Does he not understand that he's not to leave this building?
Yes!
More than 700 students are arrested, including Ted Gold. He's one of the leaders of the protest, and his parents are supportive. One night, as the protests become violent, Kapchuk calls Mr. Gold for help.
The night of the bust at Columbia in 1968, I forgot the exact date, in April, I called up Ted's father, maybe at 9 o'clock at night. I said, Dr. Gold, if I cry, don't worry about it.
No, of course.
Cry about the stuff. I said, them, Dr. Gold, they're gonna kill us up here. They're doing this, you know, for hours. Like they're gonna use their club.
Police officers aggressively try to break up the protest.
You have to get doctors up here, and as soon as you can, put up doctors. Cool, friends.
After the protest, shortly before graduation, Ted Gold gives a speech in front of campus.
We have to make the administration realize that if they try and go through with their plan to suspend or expel 500 or more people, they are not going to have a university in September that they can call their own.
Ted is spending time with a more militant group within the SDS. It's called the Action Faction.
When the other people came in, the Action Faction, who weren't particularly friends of mine, Ted became friendly with them. And I think for a while they didn't trust him, but eventually they really trusted him a lot. I think they knew that he was so fucking reliable. And that he was like, he could be trusted to do whatever he said.
After a year of anti-war protests, it's finally graduation day. Ted Gold wants to go out with a bang. Here's Robert Siegel again. He and Ted are both graduating from Columbia.
In our year, because of the protests, commencement was moved indoors to St. John the Divine.
So what Ted did, he went to Radio BAI, I don't know if it's still in New York City, and he said, could we broadcast some songs at this time into that St. John the Divine, which is a cathedral near Columbia? And they said, no, we can't do that. We'll go to jail.
But Ted Gold won't give up. So he comes up with a new plan.
And then it was like, come on, Ted, let's go. We'll buy 50 radios today and then 50 radios tomorrow. So we went down to Times Square and got all the radios.
The idea would be that protesters inside would have transistor radios under their robes, their gowns, and at a given time, a signal would be broadcast.
And what we did was, at exact moment, people had their radios on to this station that he created, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the graduation, you could hear Country Joe and the Fish singing 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for?
Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
It's 1969. College is over. The two Teddies get an apartment along with Kapshuk's girlfriend, Michelle Kramer. Together, they pay only $100 for a 5-bedroom apartment. Michelle remembers Ted as intense.
You know, I don't think I ever had a conversation with him that wasn't about politics. I don't think we ever, like, sat in the kitchen and had a cup of coffee and just talked about stuff. So at the time, he was so politically motivated. It wasn't like, let's go to the movies or let's go out for dinner or let's have fun. He was constantly in meetings, you know, and then for part of that time, he was in Cuba.
Ted only has time for politics, and he's become close with the Weathermen, that radical leftist group we told you about. They're planning a trip to Cuba. Lots of young leftists are going down there at the time. It's kind of like going on a political spring break. But the Weathermen trip is special.
The struggle on the island is not only to overcome material deprivation, but also to overcome the dehumanization and underdevelopment which existed under American imperialism.
Ted stays in Cuba for a few weeks with other leaders of the Weathermen.
Ted told me in a very casual conversation that the Vietnamese and the Cubans told them to stop being bombers.
Even before the trip to Cuba, the Weathermen are becoming more violent. They've started building bombs, small ones. But now, the leadership wants to take it even further. On their trip, they meet with communist leaders from Cuba, North Vietnam, and North Korea. Those want the Weathermen to convince their parents and elders to help stop the war in Vietnam. And they tell them to stop being violent. But the Weathermen, They want a revolution in the US. So Ted and the others decide to go against instructions. Mark Rudd is another member of the Weathermen, one of its leaders.
They came back telling us that the Vietnamese like us, and that, even though they told us you have to build a broad anti-war movement, which is what they really wanted and needed, somehow or other it got perverted by our faction coming back and agreeing that we need to start revolutionary guerrilla warfare.
Did you tell the Vietnamese you were not, that you were not going to listen to them? And he said, well, you know, sometimes you have to lie. And two is that we're not going to tell the Vietnamese what we're going to do, because they won't understand American conditions. They'll appreciate it afterwards. And I realized these people, how did they think that they're helping the Vietnamese and not at least being honest about what they're doing, right?
Ted Gold wants a revolution in America and is willing to be violent if necessary. Kapchuk hardly recognizes his best friend.
Ted's now a full-on member of the Weathermen. Just weeks after they come back from Cuba in 1969, he goes to Chicago to participate in the Days of Rage.
This fall, in Chicago, we will lead massive demonstrations against the war in support of the Black Panther Party and in solidarity with all political prisoners.
It's a week of protests that become chaotic. Before the event, Ted Gold goes around the city to try to recruit new members. Michael Pastor is at City College when he meets his former camp friend.
And he came to the City College cafeteria, and there were a bunch of us who knew him, and we knew him, and he knew us from camp. I guess I asked him what they were going to do, and he said, we're not bringing guns, which I was like, I didn't even know that was a question. didn't know that was on the agenda.
Michael Pastor does not join the Weathermen. But Ted is committed to the cause. He breaks up with his girlfriend because the Weathermen wants to smash the monogamy.
Which essentially means everyone's sleeping with everyone. Relationships within the group start to fall apart.
They have other strange rituals to prove their loyalty to the group.
They put people in the room, fucking, and you start bombarding them. The person could not respond and say, that's not true, or I did this, I did that. And then they had to publicly self-criticize themselves in humiliating ways. They abolished any disagreement with the leadership of a commune, even though the leadership changed its mind every fucking 4 months, 3 months, was a sign of this of individualism and disloyalty and counter-revolutionary activity. All these things are the way cults are.
And as in every cult, the collective always comes first. Kapchuk learns this the hard way the next time he sees Ted in New York.
So I said, Ted, how's your father and mother? And he said, great, no problem. But I just stole $5,000. I went to the safe deposit box in the house and stole $5,000 from my father. And I said, Ted, what the fuck are you doing? He said, my father's bourgeois, he's not streets. Then I go and say, Ted, would you steal from my father? He said, yes. I said, Ted, what the fuck's in your head? My father killed Nazis every fucking day for 2 fucking years. And you're telling me he's a bourgeois person? And he said, yeah, he's not in the streets. And I said, I just became quiet. He loved his father. He loved his mother. He lost the ability to have respect for them. He lost their ability to have respect for anyone except the people in their little, shrunken, isolated, intense world. That's what happened.
Kapchuk moves out to California with his girlfriend, Michelle. He doesn't see Ted Gold for months, until that morning after the concert with the Hells Angels.
Sisters! Brothers and sisters.
Births, 4 deaths, and an awful lot of scuffles reported.
And he said very clearly, I'm going to do things that you are not capable of doing. And I don't want you to do those things.
Two months later, Ted Gold's back in New York City. It's February 1970. He is 22 years old.
Ted is tasked by the weathermen to find a headquarters for members in the city. He's taking a stroll around Columbia. He runs into an old friend, Robert Siegel.
We sat down in the Columbia building that no longer exists. He wanted to know if he could if he and his friends could use my apartment for meetings.
Did Bob Siegel give him the apartment?
No.
Yeah, he's Bob's too smart.
I did not want that. I didn't know that there would be bombs involved, dynamite, but I didn't want that just the same. And I pleaded that that would be unacceptable to my roommates.
What Robert Siegel doesn't know at the time is that Ted is looking for a place to build a bomb.
It won't be Robert's apartment. Instead, the weathermen end up at a townhouse on West 11th Street in the Village. Ted's normally a leader, but in this instance, that's no longer the case.
A guy named Terry Robbins seems to be in charge. He sends Ted out to the store to buy cotton.
To muffle the sound of the alarm clock, the tick, tick, tick of the battery alarm clock.
Here's Mark Rudd again, one of the former leaders of the weathermen.
He saw that there were two kinds of batting. He wasn't making the decisions. He had, in a sense, submitted to Terry, who was making all the decisions. And he couldn't decide whether to buy batting or balls of cotton.
Unable to decide which material to buy, he leaves the store.
So he came back to ask Terry.
He walks into the townhouse, and then the bomb that Terry was making in the basement goes off.
In the next episode, we learn more about what really happened during the explosion and what questions remain. Shoe Leather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. This episode was reported, written, and produced by Jellicott Diener and Gustav Mückensturm. Joanne Fayon is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Austin Mitchell, Brendan Kilkenberg, Asta Chaturvedi, Dana Chivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries.
Sources for this episode include documents, articles, and tape provided by the Columbia University Libraries, the Bob Fass Radio Unamiable Archive, KSAN Radio, Pacific Radio, and Newsreel. Shoe Leather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Doron Zunez, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions.
Our Season 7 graphic was created by Hope 2.